Welcome to You Are Not Broken, the only podcast that combines science, medicine, and psychology to re-educate your brain and help you live your best love life. And I'm your host, board-certified female urologist, Dr. Casperson. Hello, women. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'm so excited to interview Dr. Butzbach, a doctor who treats cancer with radiation. So she's a radiation oncologist, and she lives in New Jersey, and she's a coach, and she has her own podcast called Best Life After Cancer. She's an expert in mindfulness and the power of our thoughts to create our circumstances. Welcome so much. Thank you for coming.
Yay. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm super excited. I have to tell my listeners this because just in case anybody out there thinks I'm perfect, which is like ridiculous because nobody's perfect, Dr. Butzbach recorded with me like a year ago and I lost the recording. It's my only one so far, but like I told her I'm ever indebted to her. She's got the power position in our relationship because of my screw up. So I'm so excited to interview you again.
Well, yay. I have to tell you, though, I actually think this is a rite of passage in podcasting because I lost a recording of one of the other people that I interviewed. And then a few weeks after I lost hers, she lost one. So it's, I think, just a rite of passage. And actually, I was so excited to do a redo with her. I think it was better the second time. And I think this is going to be even better the second time. So I am super excited. And I just want to tell you, I am only Dr. Butzbach at work. In the real world, I'm Deborah. So please, if you're using a name, call me Deb.
Thank you so much. I agree. I mean, I've been podcasting so much longer now, and so have you, right? That this is only better. Nobody could have heard the other one. It was meant to be.
This is absolutely perfect. You know, in life, I think we get to decide how we feel about things. And I'm like, it couldn't have been better. Look, you know, we get to do this again. Totally. I'm better. I'm smoother. You're smoother. It's absolutely perfect.
I love it. How did you get from radiation oncology to mindfulness to podcasting about best life after cancer?
So I actually got into the whole life coaching thing through another physician coach, Dr. Katrina Ubell. I was significantly overweight and miserable in my life, really feeling stressed out just by the neediness that I felt from my patients that I wasn't able to fix. And I was eating to sort of feel better every day because I knew they needed something that I didn't know how to give them. So I actually joined her coaching group and lost 40 pounds. And then I realized this is what every single cancer patient needs. They need someone to help them deal with their mindset because we can go into life thinking one way and it makes us feel terrible. And if we just tweak it the littlest bit, it just makes things so much better. So the example that I use all the time with patients now is they come to me with a thought of, at some point, my cancer is going to recur and I'm going to die. And let me tell you, that thought feels like fucking shit. Am I allowed to say that on your podcast?
Yep.
All right. Just checking. So I tell them, you know, that thought may be true 10 years down the road. But for one thing, it's not helping you to live a good life right now. For another thing, it's not necessarily true. We don't know that that's what's going to happen. So what is a better thought that is really believable that's available to you now? And for so many of them, the thought I offer them is, to the best of my knowledge, I'm cancer-free today. And that is something that so many of them are really able to grab onto and is just an immediate weight off their shoulders. And so if nothing else, you know, with my podcast, if I can just get to every patient who's had cancer and switch them from chronically thinking at some point I'm going to recur and die to the best of my knowledge, I'm cancer-free today, it is all worth it. So that's how I sort of got into all of this.
That's amazing. For people who don't, they're not trained in how we're trained right now in thinking about thoughts that aren't facts. Talk to us a little bit about how thoughts aren't real. And this applies to everybody, right? Everybody who's
Absolutely.
Listening, you don't have to, this is not cancer specific. I think it's kind of a universal thing that helps people.
So I think for all of us, we believe that so many of the things in our life are facts. You know, so patients who have cancer think it's a fact that they might die from cancer. And it is possible that that will happen down the road, but it is not the only thing that could happen down the road. And so living in that reality of worrying and thinking about that ahead of time really just changes how you live your day-to-day life. And you and I were talking actually this morning. We got up, you where you are, you're West Coast. So it's 6 a.m. when we're recording this right now. I am on the East Coast, so it's 9 a.m. And I was saying how amazed I was because you're such a great morning person. And you said, well, this wasn't always true. I coached myself into this. And I literally had a moment where I was like, wait, that's a fucking thought? You know, I might not just honestly be not a morning person. That's my brain. And it blew my stinking mind this morning.
Yeah, it's crazy. And for listeners, I mean, what I would invite people to do is like, if you have a bunch of thoughts in your head, write them all down, like whatever's going on. And really writing things down helps you see your brain so much more than trying to think your brain, right? And then when you write everything down, fill a whole page and then circle the actual facts that are like provable in a court of law that everybody would agree at. There's not actually many facts in our brain. And it's crazy when you realize that.
Yeah. When I do this personally, like what always comes out of my thought downloads is I have a spouse. I have children. I have a job. That is the extent of the thoughts right. in 98% of my thought downloads.
Facts are like, yeah, they're like the paints, right? Like nobody actually just wants to look at the paints on the wall. It's the picture that the paints paint. That's the thoughts. That's what's interesting, but it'll trip us up because we think yeah. it's like immovable.
Right. Absolutely. And one of the things that I think is so powerful is that even if the thought is potentially true, is it improving how your life feels? Is it improving your quality of life and how you're living your life? Because if it's potentially true, it doesn't mean that that's the one you want to pick.
Yeah, I love the saying is, how is this thought serving you?
Yeah.
Right. Like you can choose your thoughts to serve you in a way that benefits you or doesn't benefit. Because once you realize they're not facts, and then you can realize when your brain gets good at this, you start putting in opposite thoughts just to kind of see how they feel.
Yeah.
Right. To play with them.
For sure.
And I think that's a cool skill to have of like, if you think your thought is so real, pick the opposite and then play with like the whole path of going towards that opposite one.
And how can you make that thought be believable? So a lot of times the exact opposite thought is not really believable off the bat, but there are things that, you know, still are true and are believable. And one of the things, I was coaching someone recently and she was having bilateral mastectomy and she had a thought that she was losing part of her femininity and her husband wasn't going to find her attractive. And her husband told her, I'm so excited you're having the bilateral mastectomy and reconstruction. You're getting rid of the boobs that are trying to kill you. And you're getting new ones that are like literally not ticking time bombs on your chest. And it was just, you know, that ability for her to take his thought of the same circumstance and just, you know, really use that thought to become a little bit believable, which was so much better for her mentally of, I'm getting rid of the ticking time bombs and I'm gaining breasts that don't want to kill me. Oh, so much nicer.
What a beautiful story. That's amazing. Tell me about like how you see people successfully getting through cancer treatment with intimacy, with sex. What seems to work well for people, like tips and tricks for people?
So I think for a lot of people, it really depends what treatment you're going through. But for many people going through chemotherapy and most people going through pelvic radiation, so either cervical, uterine, colon, or rectal cancer, you know, sex, traditional sex, is going to not be feeling great during the cancer treatment. And so I think at that point, we look more towards maintaining intimacy because I think the sex will come back if you keep your intimacy during that. And I think people really don't understand sometimes like that intimacy and sex are two sides of the same coin. So one of the things that I really have found with patients is that if they keep their spouse in the process from the very beginning, it builds intimacy and it leads to better sex down the road. And what I mean by that is when you have a mastectomy or when you've had some sort of big gynecologic surgery, if you get the spouse involved at the start, there tends to be improvements in how things go. And I think part of that is that you both get to be shocked and horrified together when you first start looking at this. But if you hide a mastectomy from your spouse until everything is done, and then you show it to them, then they're shocked and horrified like you were at the beginning, but you feel judged by that shock and horror. Whereas if you do this together from the start, you both get to support each other in being shocked and horrified. And, you know, I really think that that brings so much intimacy. So I really encourage people to let their spouses see their surgery sites right from the start, helping with things like dressings and drains, even with just putting the cream on for radiation. So when you get radiation, you can get a lot of skin reaction. I have to tell people, let their spouses put the cream on. Let them get used to touching this in a non-sexual way so that they get used to how everything looks and feels. And then when you go to have sex later, it's not so abnormal.
That's beautiful. That's really great advice. I'm excited just from what I'm seeing around in my town is more and more cancer centers are starting to look at sex intimacy relationships. I mean, I can't tell you the amount of young women with a breast cancer diagnosis, their relationships fall apart after it. And it's like, that's a secondary trauma to the trauma of the cancer, and all the more reason to hate that cancer, right?
Right.
Instead of trying to preserve the life, the relationships that you have going through it.
When I was a resident, I was doing a GYN, a gynecologic malignancy rotation at Washington University in St. Louis. And it was really amazing because there was this amazing guy who had done the GYN radiation there for decades. And he told me that his observation was that 90% of marriages fail after cervical cancer treatment.
Wow.
90%. I mean, that is insane. And so when I took that, I said, this is something that I actually need to be working with patients on. And even before I was a coach, I started talking to patients about trying to maintain their relationship. And if sex was uncomfortable, finding alternate ways for both them and their spouse to feel good and how to maintain their connection when how they have sex has to change. But yeah, it's crazy what cancer does to some relationships.
That's amazing. I had no idea it was that high. What are your thoughts on cancer and body image and sex and intimacy? How does body image play into all this?
I think for sure, for so many women, when they have, I think, more mastectomies than anything else. But even with gynecologic cancers and with hysterectomies, people feel like some part of their femininity has been taken away. And clearly, that leads to them feeling less attractive. And we know that if 90% of sex for women is in our heads, if you're not feeling like you're feminine and beautiful anymore, then you are not going to have as good a sex afterwards. So I think it really comes back to addressing how you look at your body and working towards creating a body that you love and loving the body that you have.
And I think another coaching tip for people who are listening is it's not so much the mastectomy, we'll use that as the example, as what you're making the mastectomy mean.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You're making it mean that you're less feminine.
Yeah. Instead of realizing that, no, it doesn't change who I am. It doesn't change my capacity to love. It doesn't change my capacity for worthiness. And really playing with what you are making something mean, you can use that in any aspect of life, of course.
So one of the things that I had thought about with this is our brains looking for evidence to affirm our beliefs. So if we believe that we are less attractive and we think that we are less attractive, then we're looking for evidence for this. And then anytime our spouses don't give us the feedback that we're looking for, we use that to bring more evidence that we are less attractive, we are less feminine, we are less worthy of love, we are less, you know, and it's just, it's that cyclical thing where the more you think it, the more evidence you find, the more often you think it, the more evidence you find. And it just cycles up and up and up, or right. down and down and down.
Your thoughts become the facty thoughts that we say. They're like glue in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It takes longer to kind of break them down again. I mean, I think everybody should have a coach. Anybody who has sex should have a coach, because nobody got any education, right? But let alone just communicating with your spouse, right? And what you need from them and what you're making their actions mean. Like, really looking at that can go so far in improving our relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone in the world needs a coach.
I agree. We're totally biased, but we,
yeah, we are totally biased. And I think, you know, I think it's so interesting because as I do this, I'm like, oh, I need a little coaching here. Oh, I need a little coaching there. You know, and I think that one of the things that people should realize is when you get a coach, they can coach you on all these things. So it's not just for you coaching on sex. It's coaching on all the thoughts that go about your life that make you not want to have sex. And for me, coaching my cancer patients, it's not just coaching on feeling better about cancer. It's coaching on why are you not losing weight when you know that this is something that reduces risk. So, you know, I think that it just, people think that when, I think if you're a sex coach, that you're only going to work on that. And I think that's probably not true.
Oh, so not true. I think sex is, you can just exchange like sex for money. You could exchange sex for food, like all the things. It's just kind of a thing to work around, right?
And what it means about. You may want to reword that, because exchanging sex for money sounds like you're, you know.
Inserting it for money. I need to stop. But it's like, it's just something, right? And it all comes down to feelings of worthiness, feelings of prioritizing, feelings of, you know, I think all of that is like what you think it means.
Right.
So yeah, I don't think, but this is just my viewpoint, but I don't think it's like this unique thing. It's like, no, it's just another part of our life. And at this point in my life, I get coached on like my caffeine intake. You know, I get coached on everything. So you don't have to be like ultimately broken in one area to like learn and make these huge leaps and bounds about your self-confidence and your communication skills.
I think one of the things that was so amazing when I did the coaching program with Katrina is that as my eating went down, my spending went down.
Interesting.
So when I stopped buffering with food, I also realized subconsciously that I was buffering with shopping, and that actually went down. You know, if you graphed it, you know, it was like two parallel curves, which was really amazing. Because we do, everything transitions into something else. So if you're struggling with sex, the same things you're struggling with there, you're probably also struggling with in money, because they're both such control things.
Totally. Yeah. I love that. And hey, bonus, you paid for your coaching with your your increased savings.
Yeah, really, with my not going to Target and spending, you know, hundreds of dollars on stuff I clearly didn't need.
Right. I didn't know it existed until Target showed it to me. Target's dangerous, man. Very, very dangerous. That's a very dangerous
store. Target and Costco are my two downfalls.
Should be like, this is, adults beware when you go into these stores. Well, we had talked before the podcast about talking about some ideas that you had about sex and some of your thoughts, and maybe we could play around with them a little bit if you're
sure.
game.
I am game.
So we were talking earlier kind of stereotypical women, I'll call them stereotypical women thoughts, right? People with vulvas, people who've been socialized in our society as female, right? And kind of our limiting beliefs about sex on how it's supposed to work or how we're supposed to be. And I think that limits women so much. I mean, we can read all these books about like the 80 different positions we didn't know existed. But if we don't kind of dive into like, why do I feel like I need to behave a certain way? Or why do I feel like sex should come last and that I'm still interested in it? Like, that's really juicy stuff for people.
Yeah.
You want to share a little bit of your thoughts or your side on that?
So when we were talking earlier, I was saying that I feel like I shouldn't have problems because my husband is a lovely man. He's good in bed. I have good orgasms, but so much of the time I'm just not interested. And I think that this is a fact that I just don't want it. But we were talking that, you know, am I prioritizing it? When are we doing it? Am I waiting and putting that till last? Because at the end of the day, like, I work at work, I have four kids, I have a podcast and a coaching business. And at the end of the day, I'm freaking tired.
Yeah. And you have to eat and shower and maybe exercise.
Yeah,
totally.
So, you know, my thought is that I have just not a whole lot of desire at this point in my life. And you said that that was a thought and that maybe I should work on that. So what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, thank you so much for talking about this. This is going to help so many people, but it's like what we're doing with this whole low desire thing that's happening right now is, number one, I'm very fearful that we're going to start selling a crap ton of supplements for women because they're going to start looking for the answer in a vitamin, because I think it's currently an untapped market that's going to explode. So I tell people, women right now, don't go buy a vitamin for this problem, because I really think this is ripe for being marketed to, because we think something's wrong with us. We think, oh, I have low desire. And I'm like, why give yourself a label of a chronic disease when you've worked hard all day long, given your energy to everywhere else, you haven't prioritized sex. And then you're like, I don't want it when I'm exhausted and I've already given all day to everything else. And it's like, no, that's actually completely normal. Like, and what if we just told women, you're completely normal. You just saved the best for last, but you have no more energy left for the last, right?
Yeah.
And especially when women are like, sex is good. Because to me, I'm like, we can't even address desire unless sex is good. So it kind of has to work backwards sometimes. But they're like, well, when I do it, it's great. I just wish I would, you know, do it more or have more energy for it. It's like, great, put it somewhere else in your list of priorities then. Yeah. Because wanting it, but purposefully putting it down because of how we're socialized, right? Like, women are socialized to like, make sure everybody else is taken care of, make sure we do everything else perfectly. Like, we're socialized to put it last. And then we're like, why did we put that last? It's actually pretty fun when I do it. I'm just exhausted.
It's funny because once I get going, I always enjoy it. I just, you know, I think I need a mindset shift in that I have to want it to do it.
Yeah. And I'm always very careful. I'm continually working on my wording on this, because I think the short story is, you fuck desire. Like, why do we think desire is an essential part of sex? You actually don't need desire to have sex. And I never want anybody to misconstrue that to be like, have sex anyways. Of like, no, we know this is a woman in a healthy relationship who enjoys sex. Why is desire in the ingredient list?
Right.
Right? Because desire and pleasure in our brains and our neural pathways are actually two different things, right? Desire is really this kind of dopamine reward seeking function. And sex and pleasure is this very like oxytocin, prolactin, relaxing. They're literally two different things. So why are we putting desire in the ingredients list of something we already know you love and enjoy?
Right. I don't know. Why am I doing that?
Because we've been told we should desire like 18-year-old boys, right? Like, they have raw testosterone, unbridled interest in releasing a whole bunch of sperm. Like, that's what they do. And we're like, well, we're like, you know, middle aged and we've got jobs and I'm not actually seeking out, I've got a guy here. Right? Like, you don't actually have to go desire somebody. You have somebody in your house. Like,
true.
Right? And so it's like, well, of course you're not going to desire something that's in your house. Our brains are built for novelty, right? And what we give away in a long-term monogamous relationship, we give away, the trade-off is giving away novelty.
Absolutely.
And so I think a lot of women are like, I don't desire them like I used to. And it's like, yeah, that's called habituation, right? That's just neuroscience. But it's not a problem unless we make it a problem.
So what thought do you think would be useful for me going into this to help me circumvent this belief that I need desire, or that I'm waiting for desire to have sex? You know, is it just put it on the schedule and just do it? You know,
a lot of people recommend that. Especially like in the morning, if you do like a Sunday morning or a Saturday afternoon, wherever you have more energy.
Yeah.
Right. Because if you're saving it till the end, it is more lackluster. Sleep is essential. Sex is essential to reproduce our population, but sleep's actually more essential in a life. Right. Yeah. So if you save it till like you need that really essential thing right now, it's kind of butts up against it. I think, you know, desire is not necessary for me to have fun. Desire is not necessary for me to be close to my husband.
Oh, that one feels believable. Desire is not necessary for me to be close to my husband. Yeah, my brain will buy that.
I think, you know, just looking at how did we get conditioned? Like, where did it come from that I have to desire? And I think part of it comes from when, you know, we're very protective of like, women shouldn't have sex when they don't want to, right? Like, if it's not a solid yes, right? I'm on board with all of that, but this isn't most women's problems. Women are like, I like our sex. It's great sex. That sex isn't a problem. It's just, I don't have the desire for it. And right. Then I'm like, that's not a problem unless you're making it a problem. My current analogy is like coffee is water and coffee beans. They're both essential for coffee. I'm like, desire is not essential for sex.
Amazing.
I'm like, why do we put that in the ingredient list?
Yeah, because I mean, I clearly am living in a world where if I don't desire it, we don't have sex. And that is not leading to a happy husband. And then we were talking earlier, we get the downward spiral of we don't have sex, he gets grumpy, and then I want to be, you know, then I don't even want to be around him, let alone, you know, having sex with him.
And part of that is like, of course you don't want to be around grumpy people. Like nobody wants to be around grumpy people, right? Like it's not your job to hang around grumpy people. That's his, you know, choice and behavior. But I think where women get that, you know, in this kind of sex tangle too, is I'm doing this for him. I need to do this so he doesn't get grumpy. Nothing will kill desire or interest in sex faster than you needing to do something for somebody so they're okay. Right.
Yeah.
And where sex is should really be about the couple, you guys spending time together, you having making sure your priority and pleasure is there. We're doing it for you. We're doing it for we. Because if women get into the like, I just need to do this for him so he doesn't get grumpy, like you are not going to enjoy sex because it's a chore.
Because then it's another job on my check off to do list.
100%. And I think, you know, as much as women got no education, men didn't get any education either. And I would say, like, it's not okay for a man to put his happiness on whether or not a woman sleeps with him. That's not okay. He can take care of himself if he needs to take care of himself. Like, it's wonderful when you guys come together, but that might mean a different timeline for you and him, right? Mm-hmm. And that's desire mismatch where so many women feel broken because they're not perfectly matched or they're not rising to the higher sex drives, you know, situation. And it's like men and women are very different. And the way our pelvises work are very different. Like men literally have to release sperm. They have a pressure buildup and nobody ever gets taught that, right? And so women just think they have like this higher desire and men are like, no, it's actually uncomfortable. Like I'm kind of uncomfortable unless I really have an orgasm and release this. Understanding that about our bodies is we don't have that, right? So we can't understand that need to like really release something. And so like that's going back to the sex education of like, it's okay if we don't need to like release like men release. Our bodies are different. Now, our trade-off is once we become experts, we can have super long orgasms. We can have multiple orgasms. We don't have refractory periods like them. So they say like women are a slow boil, but once they're boiling, like you can really play with that. Whereas men, like once they, except for in rare circumstances, men are like done. Like they can't just keep having sex. Now that's advanced master level stuff. But but yeah, going back to like, it's not our job to make anybody else happy in life. In life, right? Like that's coaching 101. And if we're doing something to make somebody else happy, of course, regret and disinterest and like, you know, all the shoulds come into it.
Although, you know, one of the things I always say with that, I hear that teaching, but I also think that there's some role for we make our spouse happy because we want to. You know, I choose to make him happy. And so I don't like the telling people that they don't have to make someone else happy. They don't have to, but your marriage is always going to be a better place if you're choosing to make that other person happy.
100%. It's all about intent, right?
Right.
Like, and some people get super turned on by that. Like, I'm turned on that I turn him on, right? Like, all of that kind of fun that gets into it. And if you make it not a should, right?
Right.
Where it's like, this is just another thing on my to-do list. Otherwise, he's going to get grumpy. I'm not into it. I'm doing it anyway because I don't want to hear about it.
Right. This is totally where the thoughts come in, because there's a huge difference between I want to make him happy and I need to make him happy. Those two different little words in there create such a difference in that feeling in your body and that drive to work and make your marriage successful.
I love it. Yeah, it's such a fun topic. And I think nobody ever got any education in this. So many women just feel broken. And then they slap this low desire, chronic disease state on themselves, which I don't think helps anything, right? How does that help anybody to tell them they're low? We don't even have a definition of low. We just slap low on you, right? So yeah, I think most women are not broken. They just need to be like, oh, maybe if I tweaked this and this and this, my life might be a little bit better.
Absolutely. I think that's true in so many things in life, not just sex.
I think sex, for, you know, the whole desire thing is very similar to me and exercise. And I think a lot of people in exercise, if you talk to like the Olympic athletes, they do not always want to work out.
Oh, for sure.
Right. And we're like, well, I'll work out when I desire it.
Well, and I don't want to go to work.
Right. You but know, you go
like
to work.
Half the days of like the week, I don't want to go to work, but once I'm there, I'm happy to be there. I don't, mm-hmm. It's not that I don't like it, but you know, again, back to those mornings at 5 a.m., I don't want to get up and go to work. You know, doesn't mean I don't.
Yeah.
You know, just means I've got to like overcome that sort of, that initial hump to get enough energy to get to do it.
Totally. And I mean, our bodies are designed to conserve energy. Right. And so our body's going to try to really not do anything.
That's what I always say. Sit on the couch, eating Cheetos and watching Netflix.
Totally. But we're like, best life? Probably not. But yeah, if we wait around to exercise, you're not right. going to exercise as
you're
much.
You're never going to exercise.
If you save exercise for the very last thing you do in your day, probably not going to exercise as much. So I always bring it around to like, sex is not exceptional. Like sex is not this like unique thing. It's like, it's really examples of it everywhere in life and what you just kind of, how we choose to prioritize things.
For sure.
I love it. Well, tell our people where they can find you.
So I have a podcast called Best Life After Cancer. I also have a website by the same name, bestlifeaftercancer.com. And I am on Facebook under Best Life After Cancer MD.
I love it. Dr. Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.